down. I'm Dr. Bernie Wilkinson.
I'm Dr. Richard Marshall.
Good morning.
Good morning. It's Friday?
It is Friday. We just finished
Friday
doing...
Friday. It's always Friday.
It's always Friday.
It's like Groundhog Day.
Yeah.
Every Remember time that we, movie?
Yeah. I wonder if people listen to this podcast, like one right after the other, it would always start out, or almost always start out with, good morning. It's Friday again.
Friday again.
There was a couple Sundays thrown in there, but... but it is, in fact, Friday again, and we are here live on Mixler talking about mental health concerns and issues. Specifically today, we're going to be talking about self-harming behaviors. Now, it seems like we have worked to tackle some pretty tough topics over the last few weeks. And today's...
today's no exception.
Yeah, it equals that.
I'm glad we're talking about this one. This is an important topic, not only for teens, but for all age groups.
Right, yeah. Right, absolutely. So. It's a challenge. It's something that we keep hearing about. It's something that we keep seeing in the media. It's something that we, it's out there. People are talking about it, but. They're talking about that it happens, but not necessarily talking about why it happens or what in the world do we do about it.
Right.
So that's our task for the day. That's how we're going to do this today. So we're going to kind of talk about what it is and then spend some time talking about what do we do about it and maybe even talk a little bit about maybe why it happens a little bit. Mm-hmm. Cuz I think that's confusing to people a little bit.
Okay.
What you think? All right.
Well, it's confusing, but it's also probably the most concerning issue that we deal with, because when you enter the world of self-injurious or self-harming behaviors, you automatically enter the world of suicide. And yes. I think there's probably nothing scarier to parents than the possibility of suicide.
Right. And We're gonna be dancing with that issue a lot today, because we'll get to that. We'll get to that in a few minutes.
So I'm glad we're talking about it.
So let's begin with the fact again that it happens. It's prevalent. It's too prevalent. Mm-hmm. And if you are listening to this and you have not yet been affected by this, either by your children or friends of your children.
That's right.
The probability is that it will happen within the next few years or so.
Right. But you're talking about self-injury cutting.
Right.
Cutting.
Now, technically, we call it non-suicidal self-injury.
Right.
Okay. So these are what we're talking about are behaviors where the person is hurting themselves intentionally. But
short of suicide.
Not with the goal of committing suicide,
right, right.
But with the goal of just hurting themselves.
Right.
Cutting and burning oneself are the two most common ways that this is done. But there's lots of other things too.
And I think the operative words are with the goal of.
Right.
Because the goal is not to end their lives.
Right.
The goal is to accomplish something else. And it's the something else that we have to struggle with.
We have to talk about that, right. Mm-hmm. And, saying it right off the bat, that sometimes, of course, even if if suicide isn't the goal, the risk is still there.
Exactly.
If you cut too deep, if you in the wrong spot, in the wrong direction, that can happen. And
Inadvertently. Yeah, because the people that I see who cut, they start to scratch and then they cut and then they cut deeper.
Right.
It takes a little bit more to produce the same effect.
Right.
And they inadvertently or accidentally hurt themselves more than they intended.
Right. Yeah. Right. And this has become such a unfortunately common topic that there are even, books written where the main character, is dealing with some kind of life struggle and loss and trauma and tragedy and things. And those characters use cutting as a mechanism for coping with those issues. And so, again, it's just become such a prevalent issue that it's in, popular culture. It's
on TV.
TV. It's movies. In movies.
Yeah.
And it's everywhere. So, it's out there.
In fact, there's a YouTube video of I think they're girls, intentionally hurting themselves.
Right.
Biting.
Yeah, yeah.
Producing the same effect.
Right,
but,
right.
So it's prevalent, and your kids, how did I learn about that video? Because I had some young students told me about it, young kids. So, it's out there.
So the first question that I think we're going to try to tackle, every question that we ask about this is a tough question, and it's tough to answer. Mm-hmm. So we're going to do our best. Based upon what some of the research says, there's unfortunately not a lot of research that talks about this.
Right.
So we're going to talk about what the research does say, and then we'll kind of bring in what we have found to be some of the information, some things that sort of
there really isn't very much information on it because it's a difficult topic to, most kids don't admit it, and it's a difficult topic to do research on.
Right. And so let's sort of begin with the idea of how common of a problem is this.
Right.
And again, right off the bat, it's tough to know. We typically find out about self-injury either by accident or by fortune, depending on which side of the coin you're looking at,
right.
or by self-report from the teenager, usually a teenager or young adult, him or herself. And so what that means is that we're either finding it inadvertently, finding something that has been that has been intentionally kept from us, or the person is telling us. And so usually when we're in those situations, the statistics that we have are lower bound estimates. And so if we assume, and I think that that's a safe assumption, that the numbers that we have are lower bound estimates, then it's a very striking problem. In 2008, there was a study published that talks about that mentioned that somewhere between a third and a half of all teens in the United States have engaged in some type of self-injury.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Now, that includes more than just cutting and burning and things like that. In that study, they even included eating disorders, anorexia, and things like that, because, technically speaking, that's an intentional behavior focused that ends up hurting
oneself and doing
some damage to oneself. So a third to a half of all teenagers in the United States, I can't think of anything else with that type of prevalence.
Right.
There are those who say that that self-harming is. I've heard this before, and I'm not sure if you have. This is a problem with kids in the United States. They're wanting attention, and they're doing it because they just want somebody to feel bad for them, or they're wanting to get away with things. Well, in fact, there was a study published not too long ago, where they found that 13% of 15 and 16-year-old British kids in the United Kingdom purposefully injure themselves.
Right.
So again, 13% of 15 to 16-year-olds. Mm-hmm. That's a large percentage. That's a lot of kids.
Yep. Yeah. When you think of 15 to 20%, that's what it is in the U.S. too. It's about that same number. In the United States, that's one in four, one in five.
Right.
One in five kids.
So again, and these are, if we appropriately assume that these are lower bound estimates,
That's right. That could be an under.
It's likely an under.
That's what we know about.
Right. That's what we
don't
know about.
Know about most of the cutting that goes on. I'll give you a good example. Can't divulge too much information here, but there was a, There was an incident, a little bit of an epidemic of cutting a few years ago.
Right.
And we knew about one of the children who was cutting. That person identified at least 10 others in the same school who never came to the attention of professionals.
Right.
So we knew about one. She knew about 9 others.
Right.
She knew about 10 others. And so you see that this 20% may be the tip of the iceberg.
Right.
Yeah.
And we're going to get to that in just a few minutes, because there is potentially some learning aspect of why this happens,
right.
but we'll get to that in just a few minutes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so if we agree that this isn't a regional issue, it's been around a long time. There are articles and papers written about it from the 90s.
Right.
So it's not like this is a brand new thing.
It's not new.
It's been around for a while. But you know, I never heard about it when I was in school. It's just recently hit the popular media, but it's been around for a long time.
I saw a person a couple weeks ago, and I asked. And I was told by the young person, I Googled it.
Right.
And they just look it up, how to do it, why it works, what it does, how to hide it from your parents.
Right.
So they're giving each other. Now with social media,
right,
it's easy to find out.
Right.
You know.
Right. Yeah, it's scary, sad.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and for that matter, you know, we've heard of people who, you know, don't. I certainly don't encourage anybody to do this, but you can go online and Google how to commit suicide. And there are how-tos, WikiHow for, it's unbelievable what's out there.
Somebody told me a short time ago, they said, well, just Google, you know, I don't know, it was fixing a car or something or fixing a vacuum cleaner.
Right.
And they said, well, just Google it. And I said, you can Google that stuff, you know, how to change it. Don't look at me that way. That you can Google this stuff. Well, not you can Google.
Yeah.
Self-injuriate. Yeah. How to cut. How to commit suicide. How, you know, it's out. It's available.
Right.
And I think that may be partly why we're seeing this rapid increase.
Right. And so if we think of, if we acknowledge that it's a multicultural, international issue that a lot of, again, teenagers and young adults struggle with, then, you know, the obvious next step is, okay, so why? Why do they do this? And I think that it all begins with inadequate skills. And what I mean by inadequate skills is that when teenagers, and again, we know developmentally that teenagers experience a lot of emotions and feelings that they've never experienced, at least not at that magnitude, they've never experienced before. If the student doesn't have, or the teenager doesn't have the skills to cope and manage those symptoms, they don't have a mechanism for releasing it, for getting rid of it, for dealing with it, they're going to look for other ways to do so.
That's right. So to get to the source of this, the children that we see who are engaging in self-harming behaviors are doing so to manage their life stressors.
Right.
Okay. So it begins with the anxiety, the stressors, the problems that young children, because this doesn't start with the teenage years. These are young kids we're talking about, studies down to age 10. So we're talking about preteens and teens who are engaging in these behaviors.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. And I think that's a great point, because this isn't the issues that lead to the self-injury don't begin in adolescence.
Right.
And I'm certainly not placing the blame on parents or anybody else. But, you know, if for whatever reason a teenager doesn't feel as though they can talk to their parents about these issues, if they don't feel as though anyone listens to them when they need to communicate about these issues, when those limitations are present, you know, they're going to look for other ways.
That's right.
And they're going to talk to their friends and to other people who perhaps gives them bad information on how to manage it.
Right. Yeah, one of the problems, the problems we have with teenagers, especially teenager post-pubertal teens in particular, have this sudden appearance of hormones and neurotransmitters,
you know,
that happen, brought on by puberty. And so all of your emotions are heightened during these teenage years because of these increased hormones, circulating hormones in your brain. And so while younger children may have some struggles, they don't have the hormones. While adults have struggles, they don't have this tsunami of chemicals driving behavior that teenagers do. So it's more likely to occur in teens because they have bigger emotions and less inhibition. So it's more likely to play itself out in a teenager than a preteen or an adult.
Exactly. And again, you know, if they've never really learned the skills needed to manage those feelings and experiences, then they're going to look for other ways to do
it. That's right. That's right.
And you know, it calls back to some of the previous podcasts that we've talked about where, you know, we have to allow our kids to experience some of these struggles just so that they can learn the skills to deal with them in the future.
Yeah, we have said many, many times in this and the education podcast that you have to give your children opportunities to learn how to manage disappointment and failure. If your children have only succeeded,
right,
and they've never learned how to deal with failure or deal with disappointment or deal with their shortcomings, if you've never given them the opportunity, they're not going to have the skills to deal with it when it does appear.
Right.
The problem is, once again, in teenagers, the disappointments are bigger than they have been at any other time in their lives.
Right.
They may have experienced some little disappointments along the way, but nothing like they're going to experience as teenagers.
Right. Right.
And they just don't have the skills to deal with it.
Yeah.
So they resort to these more primitive behaviors.
Absolutely.
That bring immediate relief.
Right. And so with all of that said, we know that most of the times when this non-suicidal self-injury occurs, it's in response to this distress.
Right.
The distress that they experience that they can't find a way to resolve otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
Many teenagers will complain that they have undue pressures placed upon them.
Right.
And this happens even if the parents don't feel as though they're putting any pressures on
That's
them.
Right.
You know, the parent has expectations and they feel like those expectations are adequate or appropriate.
That they're reasonable.
And,
right.
and mm-hmm. you know, the kid sees them as, oh my gosh, I don't, there's
That's
no
right.
way.
That's right.
You know, when you meet with a kid who says, you know, I'm not allowed to do this, I'm not allowed to do that, and they go through this litany of this list of all these things that they're not allowed to do, and then you talk to the parent and they say, no, he can do that anytime he wants to. He can, you know, he can do that. He can do, the only thing he can't do is this.
Right.
But the kid, for whatever reason, you know, he sort of generalizes it and he exaggerates it. And so even that many times, even when parents don't feel as though they're placing this undue pressure on them, it is
they
perceived
really
that way.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Other reasons is social conflicts, right?
Right.
Bullying.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
We don't have to get into that in a lot of detail because we all see this regularly. I mean, it's in the news. We see articles written about it and news stories about it where kids who are bullied are, you know, engage in self-harming behavior, sometimes even suicide.
Yeah, we hear about the suicides.
Yeah.
Sadly, we had one here two years ago.
Yeah.
And you hear about the suicides, but you can only imagine the number of kids who engage in self-injurious behavior
right.
that we don't hear about
right.
because of bullying.
Right.
And girls in particular, because they engage in relational aggression
right.
with each other, and but you never hear about them. And that's what happened at this this school a few years ago. Is that there was some relational aggression going on among these girls, and they resorted to cutting, and then they had copycat cutting. You know, to
right.
get into that. So that's one of the ways that they deal with relational aggression.
Yeah, and it's. And it's such a significant issue that many states even have laws now that, you know, address bullying.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I know that we have one here in Florida. You know, I don't know how much teeth some of that has because, you know, it's difficult to prosecute an 11-year-old for bullying another
right.
student. But at the same time, you know, it's an issue that, you know, that we're trying to figure out
right.
how to address.
Yeah, yeah.
Because there
about?
Isn't a clear, oh, okay. this is what you need to do.
Right.
It's a little bit more complicated than that. So the bottom line is that, you know, what we're talking about are maladaptive ways to deal with intense negative emotions
right.
because we don't have another way to deal with them.
That's right. That's right. They don't. Yeah.
Yeah, and so they struggle. They battle with it, and you know, as we've said, you know, unfortunately, when you don't know how to deal with it, and you read or learn or hear that here's a way to deal with it. It made me feel better.
That's right.
You know, somebody says
this worked
like that.
For me.
Right.
Try this. Right.
And it's not surprising that kids do that.
Right.
I mean, kids do that with therapy.
They do it with
everything.
You know,
they
right.
say, oh, well, you know what, I went and talked to this person and it really
helped me.
Mm-hmm. that person, that kid that hears that story is much more likely to go talk to somebody.
And conversely, they'll say, well, I went to this therapist, didn't do me any good.
Right.
So, no, I'm not going to go to therapy.
Right. Yeah. So
they're advising each other about these things. They do that with everything. So why shouldn't they do it with this?
Right. And you know, they're going to listen to their peers before they listen to their anybody else anyways.
Peers begin to replace parents, which should happen.
It's supposed to happen.
That's right. It's something we want to have happen, where peers begin to play a more important role in your life than parents do. There's this transition from home to the world. So we want it to happen, but here's a place where perhaps there are better ways to go about it than leaving them to themselves.
Right. Mm-hmm. So one of the questions we get from parents is, you know, they'll say things like, it doesn't even make sense. You know, they're depressed. Why do they hurt themselves? That doesn't make sense to me. Mm-hmm. And that's a difficult question to answer, because when you say, you know, because the response typically is, well, it helps just because it helps.
Right.
You know, when you talk to teenagers about it, you know, they say things like, the pain reminds me that I'm alive.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
right.
It, you know, one kid, and I'm sorry that some of this gets a little bit graphic, but, you know, it's the truth about what kids say. It was calming to see the blood flow down my arm. It was the physical pain takes away the emotional pain.
That's right.
And so it's a distraction. It's a something to focus on. It's something, you know, we even as adults recognize that sometimes depression gives you that numb feeling. And so,
that's right.
You know, when they say it makes me feel again, you know, it's addressing sort of that numbness that we get with depression sometimes.
And so often with teenagers, they will sit in the office and say, I don't know how I feel. I don't know. I just don't feel right, because they don't have the words. They don't have the labels for the emotions that they're feeling.
Yeah.
They feel stuff or they don't feel stuff, and they don't know why.
Right.
You know, they're either numb or they're feeling something that they don't understand.
Right.
They have no idea what to do about it. So they resort to this kind of thing.
Yeah.
They don't know what else to do.
Right.
So this becomes the only option.
Right.
Or what seems like the only option.
Right. Well, it's a fast option.
Right. That's right.
An available option.
It does
option.
Work, and it works quickly.
And now, theoretically, from the perspective of biochemistry, I suppose, there may be some basis for it. You know, we know, for example, when you hurt yourself, when you're injured, our body releases chemicals that relieves that pain, whether it's the naturally occurring opioids in our body, serotonin. You know, it releases, when people are anxious, they bite their fingernails. Why do you bite your fingernails? Because it releases a little bit of serotonin. Why do babies suck on pacifiers? Because it releases serotonin. So we know that all of those behaviors release a little bit of these chemicals that can make us feel better. And of course, you know, how do we medicinally treat depression? Well, we give you medications to increase serotonin. So from a neurochemical theoretical basis,
that's right,
it could be helpful.
Yeah, it makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Biologically, it makes sense. That's I think what parents need to begin with, an understanding that biologically this will work.
Right.
I mean, it will produce chemicals that do make you feel better.
Right.
You
know, so not only the psychological aspect of the distraction and that kind of thing, but from a chemical perspective, maybe it helps a little bit.
Right.
Again, it's not a very safe or good way to do it.
No, it's not the preferred way to do it, but it will work, and it will work quickly.
Right, you know? Right. So there is some reason, perhaps, why kids find this to be an effective alternative, albeit dangerous and something and maladaptive and things. So, so let's shift to then. All right, so we know that it's happening far too often. We know that kids are talking about it, and that sort of spreads the word. The word of mouth, you know, spreads and increases the prevalence. We know that there may be some reasons why they do it. What do we do about it?
Mm-hmm.
You know, how are we going to manage this? And this is where there's a lot of what ifs.
Right.
You know, because you have the if-then situation. If this happens and you need to do that, if that happens and you need to do this, and it becomes a little bit more gray here, because there's a lot of factors that you have to weigh. I recently heard about a girl who was self-harming, and the mother took one approach, and that approach ended up being devastating. It was, the mother was trying to get help, and the reaction from the hospital and the people involved really was pretty traumatic for the girl. Mm-hmm. So we have to make sure that we have our ducks in a row, so to say, so that we make sure that the kid understands what's happening, why it's happening, and then what the ultimate goal is.
Right.
All the while maintaining the trust and relationship between the child and the parent.
Right.
And that is a very delicate balancing act. So the first thing that, the first thing about, what do we do is stay calm. Okay. Some parents freak out.
You mean once you find out?
Once you find out, right. Okay. So however you find out, whether it's, your child who typically is walking around the house in a hoodie in the heat of summer, walking around everywhere with a hoodie, and you happen to see him or her without the hoodie on, and you see the evidence or whatever. The first thing is you have to stay calm. You can't overreact. Some people react with anger. What are you doing? I can't believe you would do this. Admittedly, that anger is derived from fear.
Right. It scares you to death.
Yeah. But when you respond that way,
right.
It's going to push the kid away. He's not going to talk to you.
That's right.
Some parents smother the kid. Mm-hmm. They don't let the kid out of their sight. They ask them a million questions. They ask relatives for advice, and then of course the relatives then contact the kid, and now everybody in the family knows. And the parent drags the kid to 15 different professionals, and the pediatrician, the psychiatrist, the psychologist, the dermatologist. Everybody gets involved, and here's this this teenager who's already struggling with these strong feelings, and they're having to tell the story and retell the story over and over and over again, and they have all these people talking to them about it and asking them about it and reminding them about it. And again, that has the risk of pushing the kid away, so they don't communicate as well as we would like for them to. So we have to remain calm. That's step one, okay? Mm-hmm. That's maybe the most challenging step.
That's right.
At least the most challenging step so far.
No, because it is. It will alarm you. It'll scare you to death.
Yeah.
But yes, you cannot. I mean, your child is already in emotional turmoil.
Right.
And by any kind of overreaction on your part, simply heightens that his or her emotional turmoil. So yes, number one, stay calm.
Number two, listen.
If they'll talk.
If they will talk, you got to listen.
Right.
And you can ask questions, but ask a question, maybe two, but then stop and just listen.
And don't offer advice.
Right.
You.
And it, yeah, don't.
This
don't,
is a duct tape moment. You
right.
know? Don't offer advice. Just listen.
Don't say things like, oh, I know how you feel. Because you don't.
No.
Don't say, well, I remember when I was a teenager.
No,
that's,
you don't.
That's mm-hmm. fine, but no. It's not going to help in this kind of situation. Just listen. Mm-hmm. Just be there, be present, and listen.
I wish parents could understand. They don't know how it feels to be a teenager today.
Right.
You knew how it was to be a teenager when you were a teenager.
Right.
You don't know what it's like to be a teenager today. You never had to deal with Facebook, Instagram, Snapchat, texting, social media.
Right.
You don't know what it's like.
No, no. And so don't say things like that, because all it really does is minimizes their experience and makes them feel as though it's not important, that it's not valid.
And when you tell your children that you know how they feel, you don't. They know you don't.
Right.
And it just alienates them even further because they're saying, you don't get it.
Right.
So why should I talk to you?
Right.
You don't get it.
Right.
The moment you say that to a teenager, you have put a wedge between you and that teen.
Right. Mm-hmm. Exactly. So you know, so you ask a few questions. And I think that it's appropriate to ask a couple of questions.
Right.
You know, like maybe... Well, before you ask any questions, ask yourself, does it really matter how long it's been going on? Probably not.
Mm-mm.
Probably not. Mm. Because whatever happened 3 months ago, at this point today, right now, doesn't matter.
Doesn't matter. No.
What we know is that it's happening now.
Right.
So the more important questions really have to do with safety,
mm-hmm.
you know? And you know, your wording is going to be important
mm-hmm.
because, again, you want to avoid trying to act as though you know what they're experiencing. And so
right.
you may say things like, honey, oh my gosh, I can see that you're feeling a lot of pain,
mm-hmm.
a lot of frustration, a lot of feelings that you don't know how to deal with.
Mm-hmm.
You know, has that ever gone so far that you ever thought about hurting yourself to the point of suicide? Have you ever
mm-hmm.
thought about... You know, have you ever been at the point where you felt like you just didn't want to be alive anymore?
Mm-hmm.
Parents are often afraid to ask those types of questions
right.
because they're like, I don't want to plant any seeds of suicide. We know that that doesn't happen.
Right.
Nobody commits suicide because, hey, you know what? Mom asked me about suicide. That's a great idea.
Yeah, hadn't thought about that before.
That doesn't happen.
No.
So ask, you know, and use the word. Don't be afraid to use the word.
Well, even when parents come into our office and they're concerned about suicide, they won't say
it. They won't say it.
They don't say the word. It's as though uttering the word will somehow create the deed.
Right.
And it doesn't. We have to face this thing directly, whether it's drugs or alcohol or suicide. We have to use the words. We have to demystify them.
Right.
Take the emotional gunk off these words and go ahead and use them. And let's talk about it. Let's have a very frank discussion about these things.
Right.
Not an angry discussion, but a frank discussion.
Right. Mm-hmm. And so ask them that question. They may or may not respond to that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's okay.
Right.
But what you... The next... step
mm-hmm.
is critical.
Right.
Because the next step is you need to validate them. And you validate them by saying, again, I can clearly see that you're really struggling.
I see that you're struggling.
Mm-hmm. There are times that our brain makes us think about things that we don't usually think about.
Right.
Our brain. There are times when our brain takes us to places that we don't want to go.
Usually go.
Mm-hmm. And I'm asking you this because I want to make sure that your brain isn't taking you there,
mm-hmm.
and that if it is taking you there, that we do something to make sure that
right.
you don't make a decision that you don't have to make.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay. What that kind of statement does. Again, it doesn't say, I know how you're feeling.
Right.
What that statement is saying is, you know, I understand that you probably don't understand why you're having these thoughts.
That's what it does. When you say your brain is doing this, it's not that you have a problem or you're the problem or you're weak or you're damaged. Your brain will do this to you.
Right.
Your brain is deceiving you right now.
Right.
So let's talk about that. Let's do something about that.
Right. Mm-hmm. And as adults... Again, not that you would say this to your kid, but as adults, we know what that's like. There are
mm-hmm.
times when we have thoughts that,
oh my gosh.
You know, if we followed through with those thoughts, how many times would you have quit your job?
Mm-hmm.
How many times would you have left your marriage?
Made a stupid decision.
Right,
you know?
Because our brain takes us to those places mm-hmm. sometimes, and it's not necessarily where we really want
where
to
we
go.
Should go.
But
right.
it's mm-hmm. what we think about. And so it's same thing happens to teenagers. But again, you don't want to say, well, I know what you're experiencing. I know what you're thinking. Instead, you want to say, sometimes our brain does this.
And you have to remember that and the reason you can't say, I know how you feel, as an adult, you have many more choices. First of all, you're allowed to do whatever you want when
right.
you're an adult, okay? When you're a teenager, you're not allowed to do whatever
right.
you want, okay? If you're an adult, you can walk out of a relationship. You can walk out of a marriage. You can walk away from your children. If you're a teenager, you can't do any of those things.
Right.
You can't just walk out, okay?
Right.
So number one, a teenager doesn't have all those choices. Number two, as an adult, you might have 10 tools in your toolkit. a teenager might have two because they're teenagers, because they haven't learned all these things. So they just don't have as many tools in the toolkit as we do.
Right.
We tend to think that they can do what we can. They can't.
Right.
They don't have as many tools, and those tools aren't as sharp as ours.
Right. How many times have you had a patient that's an adult, and they're like, well, my husband doesn't know I'm here.
Right.
I'm just coming to because I want some help, but I don't want him to know that. A teenager can't do that.
No.
A teenager can't come get help without anybody knowing.
That's right.
Teenagers can't even go, and it's important that parents know this, a teenager can't even go regularly to the guidance counselor at mm-hmm. school and talk to them therapeutically mm-hmm. without the parent knowing.
That's right. That's right.
And so, you know, well, that's a topic for a different day, but so they don't have the options. And so we don't want to say, you know, we know how you feel. We want to say, this happens sometimes. I want to make sure that you're safe. I want to make sure that you're okay. And they're gonna say something. They're gonna maybe say something. Hopefully, say something. They may say that, well, the reality is they're probably gonna say no. I don't think about that. Whether they do or don't, they're gonna probably say no. And so the next step is let's make an agreement. If that thought comes, just let me know. You know, before you do anything, just let me know. Okay, so you know, in counseling and in our practice, sometimes we'll create contracts with kids that says, you know, hey, I recognize that you have these thoughts.
Right.
Before you do anything, call me.
Let me know.
You know, before you do anything, let me know. Can we agree on that?
Here's my cell phone. Call me.
Right.
All right.
Mm-hmm. And so as a parent, you can do the same thing.
Right.
Now, if we get to that point, the next thing is, let's get you to see someone that can help you deal with this, because I know that it's going to be tough to talk to me. I'm your mom, I'm your dad. I know it's going to be difficult, and you probably don't want to talk to me about these things. Let's get you in to talk to somebody who keeps everything confidential, everything private, and let's set you up to talk to somebody about these things and see if we can give you some new tools mm-hmm. to deal mm-hmm. with it. I would encourage you to help have your teenager help you find a therapist.
Right.
Don't pick somebody out for them. If they're willing to participate, say, you know, do you want to help me find somebody?
Yeah.
Oftentimes they will have a preference.
And I want to underscore that. I think that certainly all teenagers, I think after the age of 10 or 11 or 12, should be part of the decision making.
Yeah.
Because if you take them to a therapist that they don't want to go to,
mm-hmm.
let's say you have a young daughter and you want her to go to maybe she wants to go to a woman, mm-hmm. not a man,
mm-hmm.
okay? If she wants to, she ought to have that choice.
Right.
Because it's more likely for some reason she wants to talk to a woman.
Right.
Okay.
And she's going to be more likely to open up. And
right. Or if you go to a therapist after two or three visits and they say, no, I'm not going to, you have to be willing to change. You have to listen to them. Many parents will take children to let's say a pastoral counselor.
Right.
Okay. And this is one of the problems that you can easily get into with a teenager. You know, as you know, as all parents know, teenagers begin to move away from the faith of their parents during the teenage years,
right.
Natural thing to do. But the parents say, well, I want her to go to the pastor. Well, what if the child doesn't want to go to the pastor?
Right.
Then it's not going to work.
Right.
Okay. So please, by all means, allow your child to be part of that decision making and choosing the therapist that he or she wants to go to.
Right. And so it may be a gender preference,
gender,
male or female.
Maybe age.
Maybe age.
That's
some people, you know, they have a really good relationship with a grandparent, and so they are very comfortable talking with an older therapist. Or maybe they want to talk to somebody who's younger that they feel maybe able to relate to what they're experiencing a little bit more. So it may be somebody that a friend of theirs sees.
That's right.
That they want to talk to too, because that friend told them, again, hey, this person is really good. You should go talk to them.
Right.
Sometimes they want to see somebody whose office is in another town or somewhere else, so that they keep these lives separate, right?
Right. Mm-hmm.
So talking with them and finding out, again, some teenagers may say, I don't care, mm-hmm. and that's fine. So maybe schedule them with a couple of different people, if they're willing, schedule them with a couple of different people.
Right.
But at least get them in to talk to someone who will listen and who will be able to hopefully offer some options.
And make sure it's a person who knows how to handle this problem.
Right.
This is a very, very difficult therapy to do. It takes some experience,
right,
and it takes a lot of knowledge. And so you need to get some, many counselors can't handle this stuff. So make sure whoever you go to has some experience,
right,
has done it before, and has succeeded before.
Right. It needs to be somebody who works with children and adolescents. It needs to be somebody that understands
and really
that
knows teenagers.
Right. Mm-hmm. So, and then of course you make the, start making phone calls and get them in as soon as you can.
Right.
But again, until that point, you don't smother them. You don't, they've been struggling with this for however long, mm-hmm, and it hasn't gone anywhere else. So if you have this agreement with them that before you take it too far, that we'll talk about it, we'll get some acute help. Let's just continue life as best you can until you can get in to see the professional.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Now, there is the other side of the coin, and that is, what if there is some suicide concern? The reality is that, the general reality is that a lot of teenagers, a high percentage of teenagers, experience suicidal thoughts. Perfectly healthy teenagers sometimes experience transient suicidal thoughts.
Yeah.
That's again part of that hormonal, mm-hmm, craziness that happens in adolescence.
Mm-hmm.
So many times, normal, healthy teenagers will experience suicidal thoughts. So certainly the idea that students and people, teenagers who are self-harming will experience suicidal thoughts. Okay, so that's not rocket science, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to have potentially some of those issues, but there is a difference between suicidal thoughts and suicidal intent. And so, mm-hmm, so we need to recognize that there is a difference between those.
Right.
Have you ever thought about taking things so far that you thought about suicide?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, I've thought about it.
Right. Yeah.
Okay. Have you ever had a plan? Like, have you ever thought about how you would,
mm-hmm,
do it?
Mm-hmm.
If they answer yes to that, okay, mm-hmm, so now we have a situation where there has been some intent.
Right.
We've taken it sort of to the next level.
Right.
And that calls for a little bit more of an acute response.
Almost every teenager you talk to has thought about suicide.
Right.
If not their own, then the concept.
Right.
Okay, so yeah, the answer to that question is going to be yes.
If it's honest.
Right.
It's usually going to be yes.
That's right. And they may say, I've thought about it, but no, I'm not going to do that.
But when we ask that to adults,
yeah,
the answer is usually yes.
Right.
Right. Yeah,
for the same reason.
About it.
Sure.
Right. Exactly.
About it,
So... So the risk is there. The risk for the thoughts are there.
Mm-hmm.
Intent, again, is sort of that next layer that's probably going to require a little bit more of an acute response.
Right.
We're not going to be able to wait a week to get into a therapist,
mm-hmm,
if the thoughts have gotten to the point of,
right,
yeah, I've thought about, I would do it this way or that way.
Mm-hmm.
Then we need to respond a little bit faster.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have some options there as well. Here in Florida, we have something called the Baker Act. And what the Baker Act does is that offers the opportunity for people, teenagers, adults, kids, any age,
right,
to be involuntarily hospitalized for up to 72 hours because they pose a danger or risk to themselves or other people. That should not be your first go-to, okay? And I'm going to talk in just a second, and, we have about 15 minutes left, and so I'm going to talk in a few minutes about how to do that, because if you don't do that right, it's going to cause other problems. But for now, the point is that when you are in a situation where suicide is a concern, have you thought about it? Yes. Have you thought about how you would do it? Yes, I would do it this way. When you're doing a full suicide risk assessment, the next question is, or the next consideration is, okay, based upon how they've thought about doing it, do they have access to that?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yes, I've thought about doing it. Well, how did you think about doing it? Well, I was going to go, I was going to jump off the Empire State Building.
Right.
Okay, well, you live in Miami, mm-hmm. so that's not an option.
Right.
So the risk there is lower than if they say, you know, I was going to, you know, walk out in the middle of the interstate. Well, okay, we live very close to the interstate, mm-hmm. so that's a really realistic risk.
Or my dad has guns and I know where they are.
Right,
you know,
right.
Or, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So that next step is, you know,
right.
what kind of access do they have?
Right.
And then the final, of course, is have you made a date? Do you know?
Mm-hmm. Kids say, well, you know, at the end of the school year.
Yeah.
Or I'm going to do it this summer when we're right. somewhere or my parents are gone. Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so they can give you the more details they can give you, the higher your concern meter should go.
Right, right. Mm-hmm. And so, again, most self-harming is non-suicidal. Most of
right.
of the teenagers and young adults who do this are not intending to commit suicide, and they don't go that far.
Right.
But some do, and we have to take that seriously, and we have mm-hmm. to, and we have to address it.
Right. But let's emphasize that NSS, non-suicidal injury, and suicide are usually two very different things.
Right.
I mean, there are lots of kids who commit suicide who never did self-injurious behavior before, and conversely, there's kids who are doing non-suicidal injuries with no intention of committing suicide.
Right.
So don't assume, you know, talk.
And you would be amazed at the information that teenagers possess as it relates to that.
Oh, yeah.
You know, how many times have you talked to a teenager who you know, uses cutting, and
right.
they say, oh, well, I only do horizontal cutting. I don't do vertical cutting.
Because they know.
Because they know
right.
that vertical cutting is the more mm-hmm. dangerous and risky, and,
mm-hmm.
and that's the one where, you know, an accident of going too deep or something is more likely.
Right.
So they know, and you will be able to, you know, when they tell you that, you know, hopefully they'll be able to be honest with you, and you
right.
know, certainly your relationship over time with them is going to really influence how honest and open they're going to be with you. So,
mm-hmm.
So let's spend the last few minutes talking very quickly about Baker acting and the involuntary hospitalization, because I think that's a
before we do that. Well, no, go ahead. We're stumbling and we're stuttering.
Yeah,
because this is a very the issue of involuntary hospitalization is complicated and fraught with problems.
Right.
Okay.
There's a lot of what ifs.
Because on the one hand, it's a very useful thing to have, because if you have an adult or a child or an adult who seems to be a danger to themselves or to others,
right.
it's a very useful alternative.
Right.
You know, rather than let this play itself out, well, let's get the person someplace safe where we can assure their safety.
Right.
That's usually a hospital setting.
Right.
Okay. So it does have its use.
Right.
Okay. Then there's a huge however.
Right. Yeah. And the however is that it's a scary experience, just to put it plain and simple. It's a very scary experience, especially for young teenagers.
Mm-hmm.
But for some adults, it's a very
really
scary
is.
Experience. That, you know, a hospital is where I first started working in this field, and
yeah.
you know, I would see these teenagers come in, and you know, from my perspective as the person
mm-hmm.
working there, I'm thinking, man, I'm just here to help. I'm, you know,
right.
trying to, and these kids come in, and they're scared to death
right.
many times. Those who are what they call frequent flyers, those who have been there multiple times, you know,
yeah,
they are,
yeah,
they're
the
more of a challenging
time, yeah.
challenge for a different reason.
And typically you're brought in by the police.
Right.
You know, that's where it begins, because the police get called. So number one, you're already dealing with these authority figures.
Right.
You might be handcuffed.
Yeah.
Okay. And it's scary for most kids,
right.
especially the first time it's ever happened.
Yeah. And, yeah, that's a good point. The, you know, imagine being an 11, 12, 13-year-old, distressed,
Yeah, you're already upset.
Really struggling to deal with these emotions and feelings. Some mom finds out, dad finds out. They decide to try to get you some help. You know, the police arrive and you're right. In some places, the policy is to handcuff and put them in the back of the car and take them to the hospital that way. And
once the authorities get involved, and again, this not
the parent has no decisions.
You lose control.
Yeah.
You may be there and you may be asked to leave.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
If the child is hospitalized, you're going to be asked to leave.
Right.
And you will be told when you're allowed to come back.
Right.
You know, so as a family, that's not meant to scare you. It's just meant to say, you know, once the authorities take over, mm-hmm. You're going to lose some parental control.
Right. So you need to know that ahead of time.
That's right.
And again, it's not necessarily meant to be a discouragement from
right.
using it.
Yeah.
It's meant to be know what you're going into.
Right.
You know, I've heard parents sitting in my office when we've talked about the possibility of a Baker Act with a kid, and the parent will say, well, it's going to be sort of like going to a hotel, so you'll be able to just kind of relax for a few days and, you know, no. It's not a hotel stay. It's not a vacation. It's none of that. It's serious business.
Right.
It is what it says it is, and that is for people who are a danger to themselves or others, and it's a time to get yourself safe enough to go back home.
Right. And this is another thing the teenager needs to know.
Right.
You know, that this is not a pleasure cruise. You're
right.
not going on a cruise here. This is the authorities are going to take over. You're going to be put in this place, and it's not meant to be pleasant. You know,
right.
it's therapeutic, there to help you, but it's not meant to be a resort.
And when we say they're going to help you, what we mean is they're going to help keep you safe.
Right, right.
They're not going to let you hurt yourself.
Right.
And again, that is really important. Mm-hmm. We need that.
Right.
We need to keep people safe that way. We need to make sure that people aren't going to hurt themselves. But for the reasons that we're saying, it's not something that we jump to impulsively as the first line of treatment, the
right.
first line of response, because we want to make sure that it is what we need to do.
Right.
And that's how it's going to be most effective.
Right.
So when you're talking with your kid and, you know, what we were saying earlier, you say, I know that sometimes our thoughts take us to places that we don't want to go. We makes us think about things that we don't want to think about. And, you know, and if as you're going through that, you find out that they have had suicidal thoughts and that there has been some intent, then you say, well, I think that what we need to do then is we need to get you some help right now.
Mm-hmm.
And to get you the help right now.
Tonight, right this moment. That's the difference.
You know, the goal is to make sure that your brain doesn't keep you going down a path where it makes you do something that you don't want to do.
Right.
It's already making you think things you don't want to think.
Mm-hmm.
We want to make sure that it doesn't make you do something you don't want to do.
Right. And again, you're not saying there's something wrong with you.
Right.
You're saying your brain is deceiving.
Exactly.
And that's a good separation. You have
right.
to dissociate those two things.
Right. Mm-hmm. And so to do that, let's go to the hospital to
right.
make sure that you're safe.
Right.
And you as the parent you can take them to the hospital.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Then you have a little bit more control,
right.
at least until you get there and until
Some
they
decision
do their
made.
Evaluation
right.
to see what's going on. You don't tell them it's a vacation. Hey, let's just go, you can stay at the hospital for a few days, take a
mm-hmm.
break and recover.
Mm-hmm.
No.
No.
The purpose is we're going to go there to make sure that you're safe, to make sure that your brain doesn't get you to do something that you don't want to do. While you're there, safe and taken care of,
mm-hmm.
I'm going to work to get you into someone
right.
for real
right.
treatment, for
mm-hmm.
for a therapy session.
Right.
I'm going to start making phone calls to see where I can get you in within the next couple of days. So as soon
mm-hmm.
as you get out, we can get you established with someone.
Right. And it's a collaboration. You know, I'm going to do this with you.
Right.
I'm not doing it to you.
Right.
I'm going to do this with you. We're going to do it
right.
together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So as you can see, this is a very different way of approaching it than saying, oh my gosh, I'm scared to death, 911.
Panic, right.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's, remember, again, we don't know how long this has been going on.
Right.
So there's a very low probability that while you're talking to him about this, he's going to run into the other room and commit suicide real quick. That's not going to happen.
Right.
You know, you certainly don't want to, you know, if there's the suicide concern, you certainly don't want to, well, go to your room and, you know, and just relax a little bit. You know, you certainly don't want to do that. You want to stay engaged, stay close by, stay together to ensure safety. But you also don't want to overwhelm and smother. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I know that as I'm saying it, it's tough to imagine.
Right.
But you have to, you know. If he says, well, I just don't want to talk about it anymore, I just want to, you know, sit down and relax a little bit, that's fine. You know, go to the TV room, watch whatever, you know, put the TV on, whatever you want to watch.
Keep the doors open.
Yeah.
You know, just get through the night.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But if it is to the point where he needs help right now, you know, that's the kind of way to best have that conversation. You know, let's get you to a safe place so that your brain doesn't get you to do something that you don't really want to do.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, all the while I'll work to get you set up with something more.
And parents will often ask, well, how do I know? You know, and well, it's a judgment you make based on their emotionality at the time.
If you got to know the kid.
If they are
you gotta
severely,
know your kid.
Severely depressed,
right?
Okay, that's a concern.
Right.
If they are highly agitated and can't calm down,
right,
you may want to take some action. If they become highly aggressive,
right,
verbally or physically, you may want to take some action. You know, they start destroying the house or, you know, fighting with the physically aggressive, then you have to take some action.
And that may be a situation there where you do have to call 911.
Right.
You can't do it yourself because he's not going to be cooperative.
Right. You're calling because the emotions are overwhelming them.
Right.
Okay, whether they're too little emotion or too much emotion.
Right.
And that's how you make your decision. If they're not pulling themselves back together, if you get the sense that she's not coming back to normal,
right,
okay, then you may have to take a more decisive action.
Right, right. So the overall story here is that, you know, when you discover that this could be happening, you have to stay calm, and you just have to listen so that you can get information. You know, you have to communicate in a way, and of course all of that begins with the relationship. We've talked about that dozens of times on this podcast. You have to have a relationship with your kid. You have to know your kid, and your kid has to know that they can talk to you without you freaking out and overwhelming them.
And I think that becoming over, I'm so discouraged today because frequently kids will say, oh, I might as well just kill myself.
Right.
Just in frustration. I'd say, I just might as well shoot myself. Or
which I was never born.
Okay, yeah. And adults, schools, and parents overreact to those statements. Okay.
Right.
And they start calling 911 and, you know, expelling the child from school because they're suicidal. Chances are they're not.
Right.
Okay. But once again, listen.
Yeah.
You know, sit down and talk to that kid. Let a counselor, let somebody talk to that kid.
What's frustrating? Frustrating you so much?
All they're saying is, I'm upset about something right now, okay? Don't let those words determine what your actions are going to be.
Right.
First, stay calm and listen.
Right. So I hope that helps a little bit. Again, this is a tough topic. It's a tough issue. We wrote a blog about it. It'll be out later today. I'm adding some additional resources. So I'll have a link to the blog post in the show notes. You'll see some resources and stuff there. So if you're interested in reading a little bit more, it kind of follows the same outline that we followed in this podcast. So check that out. And if you have questions, please let us know. And check out, again, some of the resources are going to have some good information for you as well.
Mm-hmm.
All right. A couple of quick announcements. Part 1, Section 1 of the Handbook for Raising an Emotionally Healthy Child, the revised edition, will be out within the next couple of weeks. All right. So we originally published it in 2012, but we want to... We've been working really hard to revise it, adding some new information, restructuring it a little bit. And instead of waiting till the whole thing is done, because the sections 2 and 3 are really getting a rework, we decided to go ahead and release it as a Kindle ebook a little bit early. So that'll be available within the next week and a half or so. Follow us on on Twitter and Facebook, and you'll get all that information. So that should be available soon. We're on Google Play Music now.
Yes.
So that's all good information, so you can listen to us there. Please write a review or comment or rate us on iTunes or Google Play Music so that other people can find us and be part of the conversation. So, all right. All right. Well, you guys have a terrific weekend, and we will see you again next week.
See you next Friday.
So I'm Dr. Bernie.
I'm Dr. Richard.
Have a great weekend and next week, and forget to be afraid.